Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. This is LFO's 10th year. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This comes as a peace deal is brokered between Israel and Lebanon. We did hear from Netanyahu earlier today. Here to talk more about it, Anthony Dworkin, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He leads the organization's work in the areas of human rights, democracy, and justice. Thanks for coming on with us.
It's my pleasure.
Anthony, so the ICC only has jurisdiction over member states. Israel is not a member and Gaza isn't a state. So how do the arrest warrants carry any weight?
Well, as you say, the ICC has jurisdiction when the over crimes committed either by a national of a state that's a party to the court or on the territory of a state that's a party to the court. Now, you say that Gaza is not a state, and the United States doesn't recognize Palestine as a state, but the United States is in the international minority in that respect. You know, there are over 140 countries that do recognize Palestine as a state. The UN General Assembly has voted to give Palestine the status of a non-member observer state there. And on that basis, the International Criminal Court has accepted the state of Palestine as a member of the court, as a state party to the court statute. So in that respect, and this was tested when the prosecutor first began investigating the situation in Israel, the previous prosecutor, she asked the court specifically to rule on this point. And the court's pretrial chamber said, yes, the court does have jurisdiction. So that's the basis for the jurisdiction. And it's one that may not be accepted in the US. And, you know, the majority of European countries don't at this point recognize Palestine, but many, many countries do.
Anthony, the ICC alleged deliberate starvation, and the International Famine Review Committee found in June that famine isn't occurring and just 41 deaths in the entire war are attributed to malnutrition. How does this fit with the warrants?
Well, the warrants do essentially allege that Israel has intentionally and systematically deprived the civilian population of objects indispensable to human survival. So that's not simply on the basis of numbers of people who have died from malnutrition, but their allegation is, and they found for the arrest warrants that there are reasonable grounds to believe that there are, you know, that there is enough of a kind of systematic effort from Israel to deprive civilians in Gaza of what they need to live. We don't know because the arrest warrants at this point are secret. All we know is what the press release has said, but we do know the application from the prosecutor. And he said that his evidence included levels of malnutrition, dehydration, profound suffering, and what he said was an increasing number of deaths among the Palestinian population. And there have been findings from other international organizations that, famine isn't occurring that widely at this point, but nevertheless, there is a very widespread food emergency across Gaza. That was the finding of the relevant international body, 1.8 million people experiencing high level of acute food insecurity, over 130,000 people facing catastrophic food insecurity. So that is the basis for the charges. Obviously, these are charges that Israel Netanyahu and Gallant, if they were to come to trial, would be able to dispute. And they'd have to be found to a much higher level of proof than to issue the warrants. But that is the basis on which the warrants are issued, we believe.
And the chief prosecutor for the ICC, Karen Khan, has been accused of sexual harassment by a former ICC colleague. How do you think this might affect the situation?
Well, there's no doubt that the issuing arrest warrants in this case against Israel's prime minister is going to attract a level of scrutiny for the court that is going to be beyond anything the court has experienced up to now. And they have had a fair amount of scrutiny. And I think the fact that the prosecutor is under investigation for sexual harassment will also attract some scrutiny to the court. It's worth mentioning that he's disputed these charges. He said that he would welcome an investigation. He asked for an internal investigation. I think in the end, the decision was made to go with an external investigation, and that's ongoing. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see what comes up. Undoubtedly, it's part of the picture of the controversy that the court will attract. But assuming the investigation finds that there's not sufficient evidence against him, then things will go forward. If it finds that there is real evidence against him, then the case is bigger than one man. And so his fate seems quite linked to the case at this point. But the case would be likely to go forward, you know, under any circumstances, I believe.
Anthony, the ICC waited until after the U.S. election to announce this arrest warrant. And Trump previously sanctioned the ICC in his first term, as we all know. How will he and the Republican-led Congress react this time?
Well, I think that we can expect a pretty hostile reaction. As you say, President Trump sanctioned the ICC in his previous term, and that was directly as a result of them investigating U.S. service members in Afghanistan, although they didn't proceed with any kind of charges in that case. But his administration also announced before that it was strongly opposed to any opening of an investigation in Israel. Now that that's going forward and that there are these arrest warrants, I think we can expect some pretty strong moves. And in fact, Mike Waltz, who Trump has nominated to be his national security advisor, has pretty much indicated that that's going to happen. He said you can expect a strong response come January. And so I think it's very likely that there will be a U.S. campaign against the court. I think we can expect to see sanctions. And I think one question that countries in Europe should be asking themselves is whether the Trump administration might not only go after the court, but also go after other countries that support the court and try and put pressure on them in various ways to distance themselves, to cut off funding, to say that they won't uphold the warrants, and so on. So I think this is going to be, a major kind of aspect of this case going forward is going to be some pretty intense politics around it on the international level.
Yeah, it's worth noting, of course, the very hawkish members of the cabinet that Trump has already nominated who are very pro-Israel. You know, Mike Huckabee, the nominee to be U.S. ambassador to Israel, doesn't even recognize the term occupation, doesn't recognize the term Gaza. So, there's already has been and we'll expect it to be a very strong reaction. Last question we have here. What do you make of the other ICC member states' reactions so far? I mean, almost uniformly, they've come out in support of these arrest warrants, including, countries that are traditionally very strongly aligned with Israel, like Canada. You know, Justin Trudeau has announced that he will abide by this decision. And how does this practically affect the ability of Netanyahu to travel and Israel's ability to conduct diplomatic relations? As one person put it in one report, you can't, be prime minister by Zoom.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, absolutely. There are 124 countries around the world that are parties to the ICC statute. And that would pretty strongly limit the ability of Prime Minister Netanyahu to travel. And I think he would have to assume that almost all of those countries would enforce the warrants. He certainly is going to be reluctant to put it to the test, I would say. I mean, it's been interesting to watch the reactions, and particularly I've followed the reactions in Europe, which have been I would say, particularly significant, because on the one hand, European countries have been traditionally among the strongest supporters of the ICC. They give a lot of the financial resources that the court needs. They advocated strongly for it to be set up. And, you know, all European EU member states are all members of the court. On the other hand, there is a pretty wide spectrum of European support for Israel. Some countries very strongly backing Israel, others trying to adopt a more middle ground. And so we've seen some countries coming out with, you know, pretty kind of carefully drafted statements in which they say, you know, on the one hand, of course, we strongly support the court. On the other hand, we can't envisage a circumstance where, this is what Germany said, we can't envisage a circumstance where Israel's prime minister would be arrested here. Well, does that mean they can't envisage a circumstance where he traveled to Germany, or they can't envisage a circumstance where he traveled there and was subsequently arrested? So, you know, they're walking a fine line, I would say. And of course, there are some countries, I mean, Hungary, which is a bit of an outlier in Europe with a very strongly pro-Israel line, has actually come out and said they wouldn't enforce the arrest warrants. So we're getting a variety of messages. But my guess is, in almost all cases, perhaps all cases, Prime Minister Netanyahu won't want to put this to the test. But diplomats will continue to deal with him. Even European diplomats, I think, will have contact. They'll be in touch. They'll engage with him on other countries' territories. And of course, the United States, because it's not a member of the ICC, it means that Netanyahu will be able to go to the US, will go to the UN. You know, there are other countries. But yes, it will, I think, put quite a damper on his ability to be function as a kind of normal head of state traveling around the world. And it's going to be quite interesting, I think, going forward to see how different countries handle that. Of course, in a rather different situation, Russian President Vladimir Putin also faces an arrest warrant, and he has traveled a bit, but we've seen him stay away from some quite high-profile events, some of the summits of the BRICS organizations, which he hasn't been able to go to. So these things do have an impact, and I think it's hard to foresee now that Netanyahu or Gallant are actually likely to stand trial in the near future, but the arrest warrants will certainly have an impact.
Anthony Dworkin is Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off, Year 10, with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court is considering a dispute over a pricey engagement ring after a couple broke up. Oh, what a shame. Rebecca Tushnet is here to talk about it. She's a professor of law at Harvard Law School and focuses on copyright, trademark, and false advertising law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, earlier this month, as Ryan mentioned, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court actually ruled that a $70,000 engagement ring must be returned to the groom to be, who is Bruce Johnson, who purchased the ring, even though he called off the wedding with his fiancee, Carolyn Citino, who he had suspected was cheating on him. This was a reversal of the trial court's ruling that Citino should be allowed to keep the ring. Tell us more about this ruling.
So the trial court had believed the woman's testimony that, in fact, there had been no affair and that he had wrongly suspected her and wrongly accused her. And so he was in the wrong for breaking off the engagement. And so the trial court had applied basically an older rule saying that it's wrong to break an engagement if there wasn't misbehavior by the other person. And because the trial court had ruled that the donor, the man, was in the wrong, he didn't get to get the ring back. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court reversed that rule.
So they consider, they're one of, I guess the state is one of the number of states that still considers fault in determining who gets to keep the ring. How does that work? And why do the justices move away from that concept in this case?
Right. Well, it was one of the few cases or courts. So basically, there are, you know, four or five cases of like this around the United States a year. So a lot of courts, you know, don't see these. And so the most recent state Supreme Court ruling in Massachusetts was rather old. So the trial court, you know, did what it was supposed to do. It's not supposed to, you know, reverse things on its own. But the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decided, well, you know, we think the modern rule is no fault because, you know, the rule that that you look at fault was developed in a time before there was no fault divorce. And courts basically started to reason, look, if it's not if there's nothing wrong with deciding to get divorced, surely there can be nothing wrong with deciding before you even get into it that you guys shouldn't be married. In fact, if anything, we should encourage people to say before they take this very consequential step, oh, you know, we made a mistake. So, you know, breaking off an engagement is basically just not a wrongful act, even if we don't agree with your reasons. It's just it's like saying, just you know, you're allowed to decide you don't want to be married anymore. Right. The courts should not take a position on that.
Professor, in a recent interview, you expressed disappointment that the Massachusetts High Court did not give more consideration to what I guess we would call the other no-fault option here. Can you please explain?
Yeah, so to understand this, we have to go back a little bit further, which is, you know, how did we get here? So we got here because in the early 20th century, basically courts decided that legislatures had gotten rid of a bunch of torts which were designed to compensate basically families or women for sexual injuries. So breach of promise to marry, criminal conversation, which is having sex with a married woman, alienation of affections, which is seducing a woman away from her husband, and seduction, which is, you know, what it sounds like. And they're all basically trying to compensate people for, you know, loss of the value of a woman's chastity. And legislatures were concerned that women were blackmailing men by threatening to take them to court and ruining their reputations. And so legislatures got rid of these causes of action and because they were afraid that men were being blackmailed. So those lawsuits were no longer workable. And then men started going to court saying, I want back these gifts that I gave to women and she promised to marry me, and then she left me in the lurch, taking these valuable gifts with her. And legislatures, having decided basically that women were not trustworthy, courts kind of reasoned, well, the legislature can't have meant to stop men from succeeding in these kinds of lawsuits. So they let the men succeed in getting their gifts back. And so we ended up with a special rule for the engagement ring, which was that that if the women were, you know, gold diggers, then they had to give the engagement ring back. And then when courts decided, you know, fault doesn't make a lot of sense now that we have no fault divorce, they changed the rule, but they changed it to a no fault rule. But there are two possible no fault rules. One possible no fault rule is the man always gets it back. And the other possible no fault rule is the woman always keeps it. And the thing that really got me into these cases was a case involving a woman and a man who got in a fight in a bar. The man hit the woman. The woman stalked outside, threw the ring into a field, and was held liable to the man for the value of the ring. And it just struck me, this does not seem right. And so it seems to me at least worth considering that in an imperfect world, we should have a rule where the courts just don't intervene, as they don't with many, you know, unfortunate things and unfair things that happen in relationships, because they're just not good at determining, you know, who should get what.
Fascinating stuff. Professor, last question here on Legal Face Off. You clerked for Supreme Court Justice David Souter. You've got, besides this area, you've got a long bio of expertise in many different areas. Did you ever think when you were clerking for the Supreme Court that you'd be talking about the law of engagement rings and be one of the definitely the only expert we've had on in 10 years on this subject, but probably one of the few out there, right?
So, you know, one of the things that I love about my main field and also about engagement rings is that it's something that everyone has a pretty strong intuition on, because the law is struggling to both get a workable rule and also match up with people's expectations. But frankly, people have intuitions that don't match up with the law. They tend to think that, yeah, you know, often the guy should get it back, but, you know, if he hits her, then maybe all bets are off. Or at least if he hits her and she throws it into a field, you know, she shouldn't have to pay him. And it's that kind of nuance that it turns out to be very hard for laws to capture, and that just fascinates me.
By the way, the best way to find a ring in a field is with a metal detector. I've done it before. It worked, believe it or not. So thank you so much, Professor Tushnet. Thanks for coming on and joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. The rent is too damn high. We've heard that before. Usually it's blamed on property taxes or labor charges, but slip and fall claims. Kristen Thorne is an Emmy award-winning journalist. You can find her in ABC News Primetime Specials podcast. She's based out of New York, has a focus on solutions-based journalism. Love that. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen, we love the piece that you did, and you pointed out that the National Insurance Crime Bureau said that New York City, where you are, is the number one city in the country for questionable. Questionable is a liberal use of the term, as we'll get to, but questionable slip and fall terms. Insurance experts told you in your great report that fake claims are causing insurance premiums to rise throughout the city for building owners who are passing those costs along to their homeowners and tenants and other consumers. Why do you think that New York is particularly vulnerable to these kind of crimes?
Well, I do think my investigation, which is been going on for about a year and a half and is still ongoing, is we see there is almost, and it may be hard for people to believe, but organized criminal enterprise behind a lot of these fake claims, whether it's slip and fall, whether it's fake construction injuries. There seems to be groups that are really making this fraud keep going. You know, people have to understand there's billions of dollars involved in this fraud. And so when you have that amount of money, because these settlements can be multi-million dollar settlements, it stands to reason that people who want to make money the wrong way are going to get behind this sort of thing. So I'm in the process of trying to uncover some of this. So I do think that that is one of the reasons. The other thing I really want people to know, and you hit on it right at the top there, I want people to understand as a journalist that everybody is paying for this fraud. You may not think that you are paying for the settlement for somebody that slipped and fell outside a building in New York. You are. Everybody in New York is paying more because of these fraudulent slip and fall claims, as well as fake construction injury claims. And I really just want to hammer that home to people, because until people start to realize that and understand it, nothing's going to change.
Kristen, given the gravity of this type of fraud, it's not surprising that it can be a felony in New York State. Do authorities seem willing to take on prosecuting this crime, given how pervasive and costly it is, and given what is often behind these crimes? Are they willing to take these, take on prosecution of this type of crime, given maybe that there are some other issues that are perceived as more serious, like gun violence and undocumented migrants?
Mm-hmm. I think that historically, no. And I think they would even admit that. You know, these cases are very complex. They're very complicated. You have to really go through the documents, which I've committed my life to for the past year and a half. And so, but I do think that there's a new movement now from insurance companies to really start fighting this fraud. And because they're now doing that, and they're no longer just paying out these settlements, I think that it's going to force law enforcement and the local district attorneys who are aware of my reporting, who are aware that, you know, the insurance, some of them are now filing lawsuits against certain law firms, certain doctors that they believe are helping perpetuate this fraud. And so I think it's going to be hard for law enforcement to not prosecute these cases when you've got now journalists exposing it, the insurance companies coming forward. And that's why I've been so passionate about getting these videos. You know, the videos show it all. You see, you guys watched it, you see someone fall, quote unquote, and then you see this outrageous claim that they can never work again, they can never walk again, they have a traumatic brain injury, they have psychological injuries, and they sue for multi-$1 million, and they win, and their attorneys get tons of money. And what are New Yorkers left with? Paying more for everything, from your food to your rent. This is a tax that is put into everything that you pay.
Kristen, to your point, I've defended these kind of claims for years and seen my share of literally dozens, if not hundreds, of videos showing sham falls and the brazenness that these people engage in an era when there is video everywhere is shocking. And one of the great videos that is in your report is these two clowns who earlier in the day are seen, you know, hammering away at a sidewalk, creating an alleged defect that wasn't there. And then later, well into the evening, their accomplice walks by and drags his foot and pretends to fall. That's a great example of what could be captured on video. But give us some other maybe shocking, maybe not so shocking after spending this much time with it, videos that your excellent reporting revealed.
Oh, gosh, nothing surprises me anymore. Yes, and we determined that the two men on this scooter that come up and take apart the sidewalk, I mean, you actually see them put a hole in the sidewalk, take a piece of the sidewalk and throw it to the side of the road. And then we know that the man who comes along a few hours later, his lawyer is also that one of the men on the scooter is associated with his lawyer, essentially worked for the lawyer of the plaintiff. Okay, so essentially, they're all kind of, from what we can see in court documents, there is a connection there between all of these people. Some of the other ones, I've got my Emmy Award winning guy, we called him. He walks down, he's walking just fine, and he falls. For some reason, there's nothing there, but he takes a horrible fall and he acts like he just rolls around. And so we called him our Emmy Award winning guy. guy, and he, you know, he sued for whatever. Again, so people understand, in New York City, building owners are responsible for the sidewalk outside of their building. So if anybody says that they were hurt outside the building, the property owner adjacent is responsible for that. And you would think with these videos, you know, I think property owners are getting with it now and they understand your video is the only chance you have. And it's not even 100%, I'll tell you. Sometimes with the videos, these things still get through workers' comp and still our settlements are paid out. But at least if you see the video, you know, you would hope that people at workers' comp and at the insurance companies would say, there's no way we can settle this claim or pay this out. I mean, this is ridiculous.
So, Kristen, based on your investigation, all the hard work you've put into these cases and investigating how they happen, do you have any ideas as to what may be a good path forward to addressing this pervasive issue based on what you've seen, based on how you've seen people manipulate the system? Do you have any thoughts as to how best to address these going forward to bring these people to justice?
Sure. I think it's multifold, right? So first of all, as property owners, you have to have the cameras. You just have to, because there's only, that's your best shot at trying to get out of some of these things, right? Is to have the camera. I do think that our workers' comp boards have to do a better job of tracking who is coming to them. We have people that all live, I found that, for example, one apartment building in the Bronx has 30 people who filed claims that they were injured on construction sites. At a two-story home across two stories, 21 people who say they were injured on construction sites. This goes on and on and on. Now, I brought that data to the New York State Workers' Comp Board, and the response really was, you know, thank you for making us aware. But, you know, this is why journalism is so important, why journalists are so important. But you really would hope that, you know, the workers' comp boards are tracking who's coming to them, where are they coming from, before they allow taxpayer money to pay for what appears to be a fake injury. I do think that law enforcement does have to take it more seriously. I get it. This fraud is not, you know, well, there's all sorts of fraud. But once you see the videos, I think it helps people understand how this is fraud. But I do think law enforcement, our local district attorneys, really need to try, you know, just do a little bit better in terms of putting as much as they can into this. I know that they're very busy. They're prosecuting homicides. They have a lot going on. But this is something that is affecting every single person. And it's not just New York. This is across the country. The slip and fall scam has been around forever. And now that, you know, the amount of money that can be made off these scams is really incredible. And you brought up the migrants. We have, you know, documented evidence that immigrants to this country and migrants are being taken advantage of by people who should know better and who are having them participate in this fraud, are having them in some cases get unnecessary surgeries they do not need. And they are taking money from these people. And it's a really shameful thing that some people are doing, and they're taking advantage of people who don't know how our system works. And it's very sad.
It's a great story. Thanks so much for digging in on this with us, journalist Kristen Thorne. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined by Grant Dixon, top personal injury, wrongful death, and workers' compensation attorney for Dixon Law Office in Chicago and the suburbs. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And in beautiful Milwaukee right now, we have Elise Adamson, principal at Beverage and Diamond. Elise, thanks for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. All right. Special counsel Jack Smith has requested a dismissal of the Trump 2020 election interference case. Rich, I think we're going to keep Trump watch in effect, at least through the rest of 2024.
Trump watch continues for sure. I mean, no surprise to any of us and really anyone. Trump successfully waited out the election and he gambled on the idea that if he was elected, then this would basically go away. And that's what happened. Right. Jack Smith filed a motion to dismiss the two charges, one for election interference and one for the wrongful possession of documents at Mar-a-Lago. He notably, Tina, filed the motion to dismiss without prejudice, meaning that the prosecutors at some point down the road, some future hypothetical prosecutors 4 years and change from now could bring the case forward if they wanted to. It seems unlikely that they would. Another interesting move, and we'll get Elise also to weigh in on this, is the decision for Jack Smith to preemptively do this rather than let Trump, you know, and his new AG drop the charges. There still is going to be a report that will be released in a couple weeks. Who knows if that'll detail some of the evidence or the alleged crimes. Jack Smith was notable in his statement that this doesn't mean that the case was weak. That doesn't mean we didn't have the evidence we did. It just means that since, 1973, there's been this rule that you can't prosecute a sitting president. So that's the way it went. In many respects, you know, the American people spoke and they said that there was no appetite for pursuing Donald Trump for these charges. Doesn't mean that the state crimes go away, although those have some additional problems. So these are basically done. Tina?
I agree, Rich. And that's going to be a theme through the grab bag today about how folks, not necessarily on the merits of the case, but for various procedural reasons, get off for whatever reason. And I think we all expected this, knew it was going to happen. The fact that he's seeking to dismiss them without prejudice, I agree with you. A lot can happen in the next 4 years. A lot can happen in the next 3 months. So I'm not holding my breath that anybody's going to refile these even after he's done being president.
Elise, you're a former U.S. attorney, deputy chief in D.C. and assistant U.S. attorney before that. Two questions. Number one, any chance that they will prosecute Trump when he leaves office? He'll be what? Well into his mid-80s at that point, number one. Number two, were you surprised by Jack Smith's decision to do this? I guess there's three questions. The third one is, will Trump preemptively pardon himself, knowing that he could be prosecuted when he leaves office? Do you think he will preemptively, it's hard to say because it's never been done, pardon himself?
Yeah, all really good questions. So the first question, will they bring back the charges? I mean, that's kind of unknowable, right? We don't know what the Justice Department will look like in 4 years. We don't know who's going to be at Justice. I personally know some folks who were on Jack Smith's team, and they are now looking for new jobs, not just because Donald Trump has made it explicitly clear he's going to fire them on January 21st, although, you know, how he's going to do that is questionable. But quite frankly, they don't want to work there anymore. And so the folks who may have the appetite to rebring these charges will probably not be with the department at that time. And you're right. By the time he gets out of office, he is going to be he's already an elderly senior citizen, but he's going to be far into his 80s. So whether or not it's practical to bring that case is a real question. And we'll have to see. I'd say unlikely, but we never know. As to your second question, was I surprised at what Jack Smith did? No, not at all. I think that he has, you know, he has done everything he possibly he could to bring justice in this case. I think he did the right thing here. It's very clear there was no path forward. And by dismissing the cases with without prejudice, rather, it brings a path forward in the event they want to bring it in the future. But then to your last question, will Trump pardon himself? Look, I think Trump will do everything he possibly can to make sure that he is never held accountable for his crimes. And I say this because we've all seen the evidence through the filings. I agree with Jack Smith that this has nothing to do with the merits of the case. To Tina's point, these are all procedural technicalities that these folks are getting off. And so, you know, I think if the case would proceed, he has a very high likelihood of being convicted. So if there is a way to pardon himself and the people around him say, yes, yes, I think this is a good idea and it is proper procedurally, then I wouldn't be surprised if he does. I think he has indicated he would.
Speaking of pardons, Grant, great answers, by the way, from the inside, someone who is on the inside of these kind of decisions. Grant, quickly, speaking of pardons. What if Biden pardons Trump in exchange for Trump pardoning Biden's son?
I don't make horse trades with people who are known horse thieves. That's just not, I don't think that's a smart deal. I think a great question is, what if Biden, between now and January 20th, decides he pardons his son, himself, everybody else? I think that really puts Trump in an awkward position. Biden preemptively pardons himself for any and all crimes. That kind of forces the issue, whether he can legally or not. I'm not sure, but I'm not sure Trump wants to challenge that because he will want to preemptively pardon himself. It's a weird time we're living in as lawyers, especially on the presidential level.
All right, moving along, the Illinois Supreme Court has tossed the conviction against former Empire actor Jussie Smollett for his alleged fake, racist, and homophobic attack in Chicago. Rich, I guess it's all over. I guess it's done.
Could be, although, you know, this case will probably continue to provide content to our podcast for years to come. But importantly, you know, the court said not that they were dismissing or even commenting on the merits of the case. They were basically saying that it was a mistake to appoint Dan Webb, a special prosecutor who brought the second case against Smollett after Smollett had already worked out a deal with Kim Falk, basically that he was, you know, exposed to double jeopardy. Kim Falk has been making the rounds. She's, of course, the outgoing Cook County State's attorney. And she's been saying that, you know, a lot of money was wasted on the case. I think, you know, she carries a lot of blame with that. But yeah, I mean, hopefully this will be the end of this, you know, saga. It was very divisive given the allegations that there was a MAGA component and that Jussie Smollett was the victim here. But Tina, the Supreme Court has ruled. And I think maybe the end of the story, at least for our podcast.
I agree, Rich. I mean, I think when we originally covered this story, I mean, this has been going on now, I think, since 2019. So that's how long we've been covering this. And I do think that we did cover the topic of double jeopardy at least a couple of times. So I can't say I'm surprised by this at all. And frankly, one thing that does surprise me is that it took so long to reach this finish line. What I do find interesting is that Dan Webb, given where he was in his career when he took this case, I'm surprised that this was sort of the last real prominent case that he's going to take, especially under these circumstances. So, I mean, obviously, a huge legacy that Dan Webb leaves behind. And it's interesting that this is like his swan song, so to speak.
Yeah, Grant Smollett, you know, has interestingly continued to deny the claim that he staged the attacks. He testified at trial that there was no hoax and that he was attacked. Who knows? I mean, you know, I think the original deal should have stood. And I kind of agree that maybe spending more money on a special prosecutor was kind of a waste of time.
Yeah. If you really think about it, the one who really loses in this whole deal is, well, besides the citizens of the state of Illinois, because we paid Dan Webb an incredible amount of money to prosecute the claim. It's Kim Falk, right? There was a deal that was struck probably inappropriately. Most people who review it think that Smollett got a very much of a sweetheart deal, but she struck a deal. And then there was some back channel negotiations, and it was decided that that probably wasn't really the deal that was struck. And so Kim Fox loses, Smollett wins, Dan Webb, you know, whether he whether this is the swan song for him or not, he got a W, right? He won. And so really, you know, people of the state of Illinois and Kim Fox lose pretty badly in this case.
Elise, you're a former prosecutor, of course. What do you think about what the Illinois Supreme Court did here? And does this perhaps signal a decrease in the use of special counsel in the future? This and, of course, the Jack Smith case.
Yeah, I mean, I think the outcome here was right. You know, I'm curious. I was a federal prosecutor. I didn't try cases locally, so I don't know why this agreement, the charges weren't dropped with prejudice. Typically, that's what happens. I guess this was a non-pros, so there was nothing filed in court, and so it was struck outside the court system. That's what I assume. But I think it was right. You know, there was just a lot of national attention. There was a lot of pressure to do something. I can understand why, you know, folks felt like they needed to revive this case and bring in a special prosecutor to really answer the moment, because, you know, this was pre-George Floyd, but there was still, you know, this is right after the Trump reelection. So I guess 2019, I guess a year and a half into his presidency. This was big news of this racialized attack. So they felt like they had to do something. And so something was done, to Grant's point. But I think the Supreme Court was correct in the outcome. Will this have a chilling effect on special prosecutors? I hope not. I think when utilized properly, they serve a very important function. They serve a very important independent role. And I think Jack Smith can be distinguished from this Smollett case, where the case was already done and they kind of brought him in to quell the public opinion, right? Whereas Jack Smith was brought in for the purpose of every special prosecutor, an independent individual, you know, separate from the Department of Justice, to investigate some very serious allegations. And I think we should continue to support these independent investigations. And we need to try very hard to fight against this narrative that somehow they're weaponized tools, when they're the exact opposite, right? They're supposed to be independent investigators. So I don't know, Rich. I don't know, because you can take that narrative and spin it and see, look, special counsels are out of control. But I'm an eternal optimist. So I'd like to say, no, special counsels are doing exactly what they should do. And sometimes, unfortunately, we don't have the outcome that we were all hoping for.
And if you're looking for more Jussie Smollett content, you can always check out the series Jussie Smollett Anatomy of Hoax on Fox Nation. You may actually recognize some faces in there if you go back and watch, but shameless plug, I suppose. All right. Well, the public's finally getting a chance to see the Alec Baldwin movie Rust, after the shooting death of a crew member led to charges against Baldwin, which were later dismissed. And Tino just found out today, notice of appeal has been filed by the special prosecutor in State v. Alexander Ray Baldwin.
Yeah, Ryan. So that's something I'm sure we will be talking about in the coming weeks. That is breaking news. And other than Trump Watch and Jussie Smollett, I think the only other story that we have covered on the grab bag as frequently as those two is the Rush shooting, which, for those of our listeners who may have been living under a rock the last 3 years, happened back in October of 2021, when the film star and executive producer Alec Baldwin held up a prop gun that turned out to be loaded with live ammunition. The gun went off, killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins and wounded the film's director, Joel Sousa. So finally, this movie premiered at a film festival in Poland. There are still a number of lawsuits ongoing. As we know, the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, was convicted of involuntary manslaughter last spring. Alec Baldwin's involuntary manslaughter case was dismissed, but has now been appealed, as we mentioned, by the special prosecutor in New Mexico. So we'll see where that goes. But the emotions were running high, understandably, given how tragic this was, both leading up to and at the premiere. This film finished with Sousa still being involved. Helena Hutchins' widower actually stepped in to help direct the film. It appears that that her widower and their son are getting the profits from the film. Helena Hutchins' mother, father, and sister did not attend. They saw the whole event and the premiere as really being disrespectful to her and the fact that the work that led up to her killing. Baldwin was not the premiere either. And Baldwin's attorneys have gone on record to say that this was not an effort to exploit Helena Hutchins' memory or her death, that if anything, this was done to honor her legacy and to provide a financial and emotional benefit to Helena Hutchins' family. So, Rich, just as we thought that this might actually be the end of the Russ story, at least for now, we've got the ongoing litigation as well as this appeal that's just been filed to keep us busy here on Legal Grab Bag.
Yeah, I mean, there's allegations of double jeopardy here also, and, you know, continue to go after Alec Baldwin. Grant, Elise, I mean, you know, on the one hand, you'd like to see the film succeed to put some money in the pockets of the victims' families. What are your thoughts on Rust? Grant, let's go with you first.
Yeah, I think there's been some changes since the shooting. There have been some shifting of the financial compensation model for the film. You know, you can't bring back the loved ones, but I do think that that's a good thing. The perpetrator, the undisputed perpetrator, is not going to be benefiting financially from the film any further, other than what he's already been paid. I think that's a good thing. You know, these are really difficult things. Do you just pull the plug and say we're all done? Or do you say, let's get this finished and get it out the door and see where this goes and hopefully benefit the family? You know, I'll leave the criminal side to Elise. She's the professional here on that. But in terms of the civil side, while it's difficult, I think it's the right call to move it forward.
Yeah, I mean, very, very hard. You know, I'm of two minds. I can't imagine how painful it is for this movie to be out. It's not just going to be available in theaters, but then it could be available streaming, and somebody lost their life. And this woman had a child, and this is going to be in the public domain now forever. And, you know, yes, I understand that there's a compensation model to assist the victims, but how much money is this film really going to gross? I mean, it's an independent film. People don't really watch movies anymore. Like, what are we talking here? I mean, and then I could, you know, volley it back to Grant and say, let's talk about how much money they would make in the civil suit. Because my understanding is, although the criminal case has concluded for now, there's dozens of civil suits that have been filed. And I would guess that the victims will probably get more money, be compensated more fully after the resolution of a civil suit than after the premiere and distribution of this particular film. So that's my thoughts. And as a former prosecutor, you know, all we ever did was really step into the shoes of the victim. So I just have a very hard time feeling okay that this film ever saw the light of day.
Well, Jussie Smollett faked his attack in Chicago, allegedly. Now, Tina, there's a story about a Wisconsin dad who faked his own death in a staged kayak incident.
Ryan, so Ryan Borgwart, you know, this all started back in August, this saga when he disappeared, essentially, and he lost touch with his family. Authorities located his capsized kayak, his fishing rod. His tackle box, which had his license, was found in the Green Lake, and his body was never located. And Green Lake County Sheriff actually said at a press conference last week in an update that his office was recently in touch with Borgwart, who had provided a couple of weeks ago a video saying that he was safe and fine. They also heard from a Russian-speaking woman that he was alive and that he's safe in somewhere overseas. Apparently, the authorities also found out that his name was checked by Canadian authorities the day after he disappeared, which made it pretty clear that he was probably on the run. There was also some suspicious activity with his laptop that looks like his hard drive and internet history was deleted on the day that he went missing. Apparently, there were also pictures of his passport. He was moving some money to a foreign bank account and changed the email that he had been in communication with a woman in Uzbekistan who very well may be the same woman that the authorities have been in touch with. So what's interesting is here, Rich, from a legal perspective, there could be any number of legal implications to what he did, from a class A misdemeanor for obstruction to a class one felony for insurance fraud. He potentially lied to obtain fraudulent federal identification documents and to immigration officials. And everyone's also wondering, is he going to be home in time to see his family for Christmas, which I think at this point people should probably not be holding out much hope for?
His Wisconsin family or his Uzbekistan family, we wonder, right? His second family in Eastern Europe. I mean, let's see, a guy who faked something and then lied to authorities, and then we wasted a bunch of money on it. Where have we heard this story before? Just a few seconds ago. Yeah, I mean, this guy's nuts. I mean, it's like, how about just getting a divorce, you know? How about just telling your wife, hey, it's not working out, and let's get a divorce instead of faking your own death? And the guy went to, like, just such elaborate steps. I mean, you know, and you know, who even knows? He released that video, and it's a great, at least it's a great example of, like, what I love about these stories is there's always internet sleuths. Like, people have been analyzing, like, the door frame in back of him and the vent, and they said that's only a vent you would find in, you know, this part of Europe. So, you know, good job by the internet, but let this guy just go away forever, I hope.
Yeah, this is like a 90-day fiance, a different way, right? I mean, this is just nuts. And, you know, if you don't like your family, you know, you don't have to leave for Thanksgiving. Just leave forever and go to one of the stands. In this case, Uzbekistan. Yeah. But yeah, I called this story 90-day fiance a different way.
At least, like, already the fact that we're talking about this guy just feeds into the whole dynamic that this guy's just looking for attention, probably.
Oh, yeah. Totally nuts. And, you know, the case that I thought of when I read about this was the young lady who faked her kidnapping last July. I don't know if you recall that, where she claimed there was a toddler on the side of the road, and just same thing. I think the internet sleuthed it out before detectives, or at least they had a pretty good idea based upon a wig that was left in her car. I think some folks said no one would leave an expensive wig like that. Like, it just, it didn't, something like that. The internet's great. I love the internet. But yeah, I mean, it just, he really, this one really took the cake. There was no reason for any of this. He could have just walked out. And I mean, think about the trauma he's inflicted on his children. I think he's a father of three.
Yeah,
you think your dad's dead, and no, your dad's actually alive. He's just shacked up with some, you know, Russian woman in Uzbekistan. It just, it makes no sense. And I agree. He was probably, you know, midlife crisis, maybe. I hate to say it, but he's internet famous now. He got what he wanted. And it'll be interesting to see if these crimes are charged and then serious enough to get Interpol involved to have him extradited back to the U.S.
Professional athletes are apparently being targeted in a sophisticated burglary scheme. Rich, so far, players from the NFL and NBA have been robbed by this group.
Yeah, I mean, homes of Patrick Mahomes of the Chiefs, Travis Kelce.
Bobby Portis Jr. up in Milwaukee, where Elise is at right now.
Where Elise is at right now, who took to social media and offered, I think a $40,000 reward. You know, Portis won a ring. All these guys won rings with their team, so you would think that that would be one of the targets, but you know, the respective leagues have got involved and said, you know, basically use common sense, don't leave these valuables at home. But I mean, these guys have, you know, multi-million-dollar homes, sometimes more than that. Travis Kelce, I think, was $20,000 he had in cash. That's the least of it, right? I mean, imagine you got your hands on some of those Travis Kelce tapes. Who knows what's going on there with some video, maybe, but. Yeah, I mean, it's to be expected, I guess. Maybe get better security if you're Mahomes and Kelce, Tina. But no one likes to have their homes broken into, of course.
Well, I agree, Rich. I mean, I think that this is quite a testament to the sophistication that people who want to break the law, like the efforts that they will go to And it's not like these guys cannot be on social media. I mean, they're going to, people are going to know because of where they are playing games that they're not around. But I agree with you. They've got to, I think, be much more aggressive in terms of watching their homes, having security, having people there. It's just remarkable to me just how successful these burglars have been. And it's amazing to me in this day and age with security systems being what they are and security, having security detail, et cetera, that these types of things are still happening in such an orchestrated way.
Yeah, Elise, you could find pretty much anything on the web, and especially the dark web these days. Do you think, and the NFL said, you know, like, be mindful of social media. Patrick Mahomes, you know, brought cameras into his home for a series. It's not uncommon for players to do that. Do you think that they ought to be smarter with exposing themselves on social media, given these crimes?
I mean, I think everybody
not to victim blame, of course. It's not their fault, right?
But no, of course. No. I think everybody ought to exercise, more awareness of internet safety with respect to privacy concerns, because we're talking about this because they're famous athletes. But these types of crimes occur everywhere, right? I mean, this one, to your point, Rich, is very sophisticated, and they're targeting these sports celebrities. But you have crime rings that target just regular folks who have a lot of money, and they did it before the internet existed. The internet just makes it a lot easier. So yes, but I think everybody should exercise that caution. But that being said, on the other hand, anybody can get this information. You can find out where folks live.
Yeah,
easily. And to your point, their travel schedules, we know where they're playing. It's on broadcast television. So yeah, they can be more cautious. But if somebody wants to make you a victim and you have sophisticated criminals, they are certainly going to try. So that's when the security comes in. And it's a very sad fact of life. But when you live a public life, I think that is a reality.
Most of these robberies have happened while the athletes are actually participating in their sport at their game, which is kind of wild. All right. Quitting your XM Series subscription is easier said than done. But Rich, a New York judge ruled against the satellite radio and streaming giant for unfair business practices.
I mean, listen, I love Sirius. I've been a customer since day one. But for God's sake, thank God for this lawsuit. You know, some of these lawsuits brought by government officials you think are a little frivolous. I love this one because for God's sake, make it easier to cancel shit. Right. I mean, you know how hard it is? You know how easy it is to sign up for something? You know how hard it is, conversely, to quit it? You got to jump through every hoop, and they keep asking you, Tina, are you sure? Are you sure you want to end this relationship with me? We can make it easier. We can make it cheaper. We can make it longer. Just make it as easy to quit as it is to sign up. That's all we want as consumers, right? So I think Letitia James here, the New York's attorney general, did a good thing here.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, I agree with you that I would love for it to be as easy to quit things as it is to sign up. I would caution all our listeners, when you sign up for things, please do read those things, whether they're click-through licenses or what have you, because those are terms that are binding on you. It's when it gets really egregious, though. I don't think it's ever going to be as easy to quit something as it is to sign up for something. But as you said, Rich, when it gets egregious to the point where, like, you're on the phone for hours to try to quit something, that's where it gets a little bit dicier, and it's something that companies shouldn't do. But I agree with you. It's super aggravating when you can't get through on the phone, can't get through on email, and you're, paying through the nose for whatever it is you're trying to quit.
Grant, the evidence showed that on average it took 11.5 minutes and 30 minutes on the phone or online, 11.5 minutes on the phone, 30 minutes online to cancel. It can't be that hard to click a box.
No, I lived this one. My father-in-law unfortunately passed away a few years ago. We had Sirius XM in his car, and we sold the car. And it took us multiple phone calls to cancel XM in a car we didn't own, and the owner of the car was dead. So it is crazy. This is a great case. It's one of those examples. We all know that we've lived this pain, how hard it is. And I'm glad to see that this particular case moved forward and really did kind of make this, hopefully, make it easier. And maybe this is a lesson for all of these guys who are writing these end user license agreements that maybe Tina reads these things, but I never do. And it's getting rid of one of these services is way harder than getting in.
Hopefully this puts Facebook on notice. I don't know if you've ever tried to cancel Facebook, but that is a thing. All right. Who other than Tina would have thrown this one into the grab bag? A five course Feast of Thanksgiving themed copyright cases.
Ryan, I promise they're more entertaining than your lead into the story. But every year, as our listeners know here on Legal Face Off, we talk about holiday themed cases. And this year, I am so happy that these are intellectual property Thanksgiving related cases. And, you know, I find them humorous in every shape and form. And I would love to hear what our guests think. But every year we talk about recipe copying, greeting cards that have cornucopia scenes, turkey decoys and plastic wishbones, just to name a few. How protectable are these things? Well, sometimes they are protectable and sometimes they're not. But my favorite in this list of copyright holiday theme lawsuits this year is the lawsuit involving the Jordan Peele movie Get Out from a few years ago, where about a number of years ago, this writer, Tia Griffin, actually sued Jordan Peele, claiming that he committed copyright infringement with this film. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's a thriller about some bad goings on at a wealthy couple's country house. This writer, Tia Griffin, alleged that Jordan Peele copied parts of her self-help book about dating and religion when he came up with this film. So, and I'm not joking here when I say that this case focuses on one paragraph in the book that was the focal point of her lawsuit, where she referred to an incident in which she and her ex-boyfriend hit a deer while driving to his family's house for Thanksgiving dinner. Apparently there was a similar scene in Peele's movie where the couple hits a deer while they are driving. What's interesting is that Peele's film, for the record, did not happen during Thanksgiving. It's just this one overlap of a scene of a couple hitting a deer that she used as a basis for a copyright infringement, which is crazy. So I'd love to hear what everybody else thought of these other cases, but I love that one.
I mean, that was a good one. You mentioned the recipe cases. You know, listen, turkey is one of the most boring things out there. There's only so many ways to do turkey, yet courts have ruled that there are versions of turkey recipes that are protectable, right? I mean, the language is from the Copyright Office that the substantial literary expression in the form of explanation of directions accompanying a recipe may be copyrightable. I mean, like, that's rough. So be careful when you're sharing those recipes, Grant and Elise, because they may be protected.
Yeah, I was wondering how many people have hit deer in Wisconsin. Maybe Elise can help us out. But how is that an unusual thing? I love the Hatfield and the decoys one. You know, it just shows that everybody hates lawyers until you need one, right? And if they'd just done their diligence up front and gotten a lawyer involved and made sure they worked out who actually owned the information that was part of these decoys for these duck decoys, they probably would have saved themselves a lot of money and a lot of time and headaches. But yeah, it's, you know, this time of year, these things pop up and it's fun to read them. But real cases with real issues.
They pop up, no pun intended, right?
Exactly. You caught it. You caught it, Rich.
I got it. Well, we'll end off, Elise. We'd like to get to know our guests. And speaking of Thanksgiving, we may have done this one before. Who knows? But let's go around the horn and talk about your favorite Thanksgiving dish. We'd love it if no one repeats them. So you get the good luck of going first, Elise. What is your favorite Thanksgiving dish that you'll be enjoying around the table in a couple of days?
That is so hard. That is so hard. And also, you know, once I disclose what it is publicly, I feel like it's going to, you know, start some kind of family feud because we know who makes it, right? Okay, let me see how I'm going to get in the least trouble.
Drum roll. Who's going to be mad with this answer?
Exactly. Let's say macaroni and cheese. We're going to say macaroni and cheese.
Nice. Oh, can't go wrong with that. Grant?
The safe answer.
Okay.
That's a great answer.
I've got a weird one. I'm going to create, there are two camps here. I love beets. And so my wife makes a beet salad for Thanksgiving. It's the only time of year we get it because to preserve my marriage, I never ask for it any other time because she hates beets. So, but I love beets. So that's always my favorite dish of Thanksgiving.
Words we've never heard on this podcast before. Go ahead, Ryan, favorite Thanksgiving dish.
My wife makes White Castle stuffing. She puts that in the turkey.
I saw that on TV this week.
The key is to go on Wednesday and load up on all the sliders. And, you know, that's kind of your Wednesday meal. And then the ones that don't get eaten go into the bird.
Very good. Tina.
Hey, well, I was going to say stuffing, but it's not White Castle. So does that count as a separate one?
Stuffing's good. As long as you don't call it dressing, I find that weird. My favorite, you guys have said, you know, my favorite, I mean, turkey is amazing. I love gravy. You know what I hate, though, I don't like, and, you know, I being from Canada, it's not the same traditions as you guys, but the hell that marshmallow thing you guys do? How are you eating marshmallow at the same time you're eating, like, beans and turkey? What the hell's up with that?
Just clearing out the cabinet, Rich. Just clearing out the cabinet.
That's bizarre.
Why, but Rich, do you celebrate Canadian Thanksgiving? My sister-in-law is Canadian, so I get both.
I have both, man. Best of both worlds.
All right.
Lisa, chime in here.
What do you got? Yeah, Lisa. We almost forgot Lisa. Very important.
Green bean casserole is my all-time favorite.
Ooh.
Good choice.
Very good. Do you like nuts in there or no?
I like it both. I'll take it however I can get it.
Oh, very good.
That is the healthiest thing anybody has said so far.
Right. I'm sure beets are a power food or, you know.
Yes, but there are things that people do to beets that can make them unhealthy, as I'm sure Grant knows.
For sure.
Thank you so much, Elise Adamson and Grant Dixon. That'll do it for the latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Kristen Thorne, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Harvard Law Professor Rebecca Tushnet, and Anthony Dworkin, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...